This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. From time to time, we check in with Morton Marcus, a noted Indiana economist, who for many, many years was the lead economist at the IU Bloomington campus, would make the treks with his colleagues around the Hoosier State on their usual road trips to talk to communities, including here in Northwest Indiana, about the state of the Indiana economy. And he brings up these topics when we get him on Regionally Speaking, as we are doing today. Morton, thanks for being back with us.
Well, thank you, but I have to correct you. I was not the leading economist.
Oh, you weren't?
Of anything. No, all I did was drive the car.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes, yes. To call me the leading economist is an insult to many others.
But you had a lot of very, very learned colleagues through the years, I know, that have helped out, and especially trying to do the analysis and determine what Indiana was really supposed
that's
to be
right.
like. That's
right.
the important
but
part.
Let's just be careful about who we call a leading economist, because
okay.
that's a good way for me to get assassinated.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, some of your colleagues are probably still around, aren't they? So you have to.
Some of them are around, and jealousy is rampant.
Oh, I can understand that. Well, we'll set that aside for now, and
okay.
we'll go on to more important things.
Good.
Just recently, here in one of your columns that's out there as well, talking about rankings, and in particular, let's talk first here, and it's a big issue these years because of the fact that that higher education is. Under review, at least the budgets in the State General Assembly budget under review for the next couple of years. The presidents of IU and Purdue went before lawmakers here just this past week talking about how they'd like to see their budgets shape up for the
mm-hmm.
next 2 years. But we noticed that Indiana doesn't rank very high, at least according to one report across the nation. Tell us what U.S. News and World Report had to say.
U.S. News and World Report puts out a ranking on all the states in almost every reasonable category they can. And their higher education ranking for the state of Indiana is 47th among the 50 states. Now, that would be true if they were looking at our hockey teams, but it isn't true if you're looking at higher education in general. We have a very fine, excellent institutions. But the problem with U.S. News and World Report is they looked at graduation rates within the usual time period. They looked at, and those are particularly bad if you're looking at, if you're including Ivy Tech, which they do. And that is absolutely wrong. We shouldn't be looking at graduation rates. We shouldn't be looking at tuition. We shouldn't be looking at how much debt the students have. That's not the way you measure the quality of higher education. And to call Indiana 47th is just disgraceful. What it does is it says that the educational value doesn't mean anything. And to me, I know from personal experience that one lecture in one class can change a life's course.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that from teaching at IU for 33 years, that the value of education is what it can do to help a student become a mature member of society. That's why we have higher education. It is not so that you can earn more money on the job. It is not so that you will get a job that pays a lot of money. It's not to complete in a certain period of time. It has, these are other characteristics, but it's like looking at, at baseball and saying which teams, scored the most runs over the course of the World Series. That's not the issue. It's the issue of how well they played to win the game.
I suppose, too, that the higher education should, as rightfully should be, a part of the quality of life for a community or an entire state, for that matter. It shouldn't
Absolutely, but it doesn't matter how many people have bachelor's degrees. You know, what matters is how many people have had certain kinds of experiences that you can get in college. And this is one of the reasons I always stress the idea that you shouldn't live at home so that you can have a different experience. Part of the whole purpose of having higher education is to, again, form that mature individual. And we don't do that. We don't measure that when we're thinking in legislative terms. The legislature wants to know, how fast can this factory grind out those degrees? Well, that's not really what we're there for.
I know that the U.S. News and World Report also had a recent article, too, that I know was picked up by some of the print media across the state talking about the state government, but actually you're talking more about state government finance matters rather than rather than government itself.
Not talking at all about the quality of our roads, not talking about the quality of our schools, not talking about how safe are the water mains in our cities or the gas mains in our cities, not how good our police department is, but how much we spend. And the only things they really looked at are the overall questions at the state level about state government finance. Now, that's important. Nobody says it isn't important. But there's much more to government in Indiana than just the state government. You can't neglect the financial aspects of our cities and our towns and our counties and our schools and our libraries, all of which are publicly financed.
Now, how did, according to the reports and the information that was in that article in U.S. News and World Report, how did Indiana rank?
Oh, Indiana's at the top. We're the very best. We're number one. Well, that's just absolutely crazy. And, you know, it's like, I don't know, it's like picking Miss America on how bright her smile is. There's more to the civic body than just its smile.
I know that you've also covered.
Is this getting too risque for your program?
No, I don't think so. We'll see. We'll tell it as it is, and that's what you're certainly doing that today. One of the other articles I know in one of your recent columns talked about, we're comparing Indiana to the rest of the country, and you talked a lot here about some statistics that were in the article that was in the magazine. But also, too, there's some other data that even though it's a couple years old now from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis that does show that Indiana compares relatively fairly, I guess, to other states.
Well, I'm not sure exactly which measure you're talking about.
Well, you're talking about personal income and things
like that. Oh, personal income, yes. Well, yeah, we're in the middle of the pack, but we're not anything sensational. I'm going to have to take a little exception with you there, Chris, because the data are 2015, I think, and it's 2017 now.
It's not current.
If your listeners paid more in taxes, we could get those statistics faster. And so it's the fault of your listeners and your station. You know, you guys raise money for yourself, but you never raise money for the government so it can collect data faster.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And that's where the fault lies. So don't start knocking it by saying they're old data. They're the newest we have.
What are some of the issues that you keep an eye on besides the economic issues here in Indiana, especially what's happening with our lawmakers? We talk here about budgetary matters, and that's mainly because this is the legislative session where we're writing a new two-year state budget, and that's why we're having all these discussions, why all these state agencies have come in almost hat in hand before lawmakers, trying to portray their particular operations as worthy, certainly, of continuing what they're making and even making even more here. But we have some other matters that come up that I know that you keep an eye on, too, involving the elections and how districts are created in Indiana and how lawmakers, in turn, are selected by the voters, of course, but that is turn basis what happens as far as the districts that they happen to represent.
That's right. And the system that we have in Indiana allows the lawmakers to pick their voters rather than the voters picking the lawmakers. And that's because the legislature has the power to decide what the maps look like. And whether you're in one district or whether you're in a district that is now across the street, it's a terrible system that we have in Indiana. We can't even get a bill voted on in committee in the House of Representatives here in the state of Indiana. The chairman of the committee, who's from Columbus, Indiana, Milo Smith, refused to bring the bill before the committee. And there's only one reason for that, and that is they don't want to be on record for doing something honest. They want to stay off the record so they can do something that is fundamentally dishonorable, and that is to keep the current system. And there are very, very many people across the state of Indiana who have put a tremendous amount of effort into trying to get a good program before the legislature. If the legislature doesn't think it's a good program, let them make some changes in it, but at least go out on record and vote for or against something.
And we know here in Northwest Indiana, in particular in Lake County, that lawmakers are not going along with the idea of getting a better way, perhaps, to set up the districts. They've asked local elections officials to have to make the decision to change the districts around, in particular, precincts in particular, having to change them around to make them fit what the lawmakers feel should be done, rather than trying to do it on a wider basis.
Well, This does go all the way down to the local level, to the precincts. I don't know what the specifics are in each of the communities here in Lake County, but we do have a real problem if we don't just use the data and say how many people live there, not how many voters are there, but how many people live there. Each person needs to be counted in a district, and we can't say, well, we're only going to count the voters. They're the only ones who matter. It's each person. So you've got to take the statistics that we have from the Census Bureau and use those as the official statistics that you use. You also can't say, well, these people tend to vote Democrat, so we'll stick them all together, and these people vote Republican, we'll stick them all together. That's not the way you do it. All you do is count the numbers of people.
Do you think that there need to be any changes made, in your opinion, that it should be done during this off-election year, so to speak?
Now is not the time to do it. Mm-hmm. The time to do it is after we have the new data from the census, which will be out in around 2021. That's the time to do it. Right now, we'd have to do it with older data from the census of 2010. There have been just too many changes that have taken place in our communities. Some areas have grown, some areas have contracted. Unless you have very detailed block-by-block data, you really can't be able to do this.
Mort Marcus is an Indiana economist. He's also a writer as well as an author. He's one that puts out regular columns across Indiana, and he joins us on Regionally Speaking to talk about these issues. Morton, thanks very much for being with us today. Back with you soon, we hope.
Always a pleasure, sir. Take care.
Thank you. Spring cleaning is underway in Gary, and it's the annual campaign against the city's legendary urban blight. The mayor says that they're making progress because of help from local contractors who are donating time and resources. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore has a story for us today on how the wrecking ball is bringing hope for a better future in the Steel City.
The mayor says there are about 5,000 abandoned and dilapidated buildings in Gary. They make neighborhoods a less desirable place to live, and they're also dangerous and they lure crime.
You know, if you look around here, there's a lot of work to do in Edmond. And to have 8 houses come down at one time, that's significant, but it does let residents understand that we are paying attention, that we are looking for innovative ways to meet their needs.
Ronald Brewer is the president of the Gary City Council. He knows Etna. He used to live here. He has seen how one bad house can destroy a community.
I remember as a young man inside this community, I used to be the paper boy, serving this side and the other side of Etna. My mother still stays here. She's on the other side of Etna there. I go to church right here. It's that one house that neighbors talk about, that how the neighborhood is doing well, but you had that one house, either someone passed away or the house caught on fire, and it's just been standing for years and nothing has happened. People want to see, neighbors in that community want to see those type of structures come down. That's very important to them.
State and federal dollars are being used to knock down these buildings, but these 10 homes are being taken down by local builders for free. The mayor says the project is helping them save $100,000. The companies include Sealy Construction Services, PC Trucking, Haas Construction, McAllister Equipment, and Rice Raleigh Construction. Jim Wiseman is with Rice Riley Construction. He's born and raised in Gary, right in this very neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, I remember this park playing at as a kid. It's updated now. It's actually a nicer park than when I was a kid, but I do. I can walk up down any of these streets and tell you, well, such and such lived here and such lived here. This was my community. I walk these streets. These old legs have been up and down these streets along many, many times walking from Etna to Miller. And so it's even more special for me because I've seen what it was and I know where it's at. And, you know, it breaks my heart every day when I drive through here for the folks that are here and the children in the communities.
Mary Riley is what you call a legacy resident. She has lived here for 63 years.
The whole neighborhood's just dilapidated, isn't it? They don't keep it up. You see all these vacant lots? Well, I'm the one trying to mow them, and it's too much for me now.
What is it like to see this house coming down next door to yours?
I am so happy to see that. That house was a disgrace. It was falling in anyway.
In the Etna section of Gary, Indiana, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
The Chicago government has responded to Governor Eric Holcomb's emergency declaration covering the city's lead contamination crisis. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen reports that the city says it needs more than $56 million.
In his executive order declaring an emergency, Governor Eric Holcomb asked the city to provide his office with an assessment of additional resource needs. East Chicago Mayor Anthony Copeland identified 15 projects totaling over $56 million to help the city address the lead contamination crisis. The top project on the list? Replacing lead drinking water service lines and other underground water utilities. The cost for doing so within the USS Lead Superfund site is over $40 million, and the city estimates an additional $30 million would be needed to replace the remaining service lines citywide. While the city currently feeds phosphate into the drinking water supply to prevent lead from leaching out of pipes, the report says, quote, ultimately the only way to eliminate lead is to remove the lead service lines. Some of the other projects identified by the city include lead paint abatement, home water filters, and replacing water fixtures in schools and public buildings. In an emailed statement, Governor Holcomb's office said they received the report and they are working on it. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
The family of a Northern Indiana man is speaking out after U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers detained him during a routine check-in last month. Roberto owns a popular restaurant in St. Joseph County. He has a Social Security card, and he pays taxes. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier says he's in custody because of an incident that happened more than 15 years ago.
Known in Northern Indiana. People come here just as much for the friendly staff as they do for the steak.
We feel like a big family.
That's Paula Barnett, who's worked at Eddie's for several years. She says this place hasn't been the same over the past month. The patriarch of the business and the family is gone.
How could this be? I mean, this man pays our checks, pays his taxes.
Roberto Barry Stein came to the United States illegally in 1998, but had since gotten documentation to work here. He owns Eddie's Steak Shed and traveled to Indianapolis with his wife Helen last month for his yearly check-in with immigration officials.
They came outside in the car, knocked on the window, and they said, "Are you Roberto's wife?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Well, your husband has been detained due to a deportation he had 16 and a half years ago." And I told them that's a joke. And they said, "No, it's true."
Helen says the incident the officers were referring to stems back to 2000. She and Roberto decided to take a trip to Niagara Falls, but took the wrong route and found themselves crossing the border to Canada. Roberto was detained when officers discovered he didn't have documentation.
We got a lawyer, and the attorney got him on a bail for $1,500, and they told him that you have to leave voluntarily in a month.
But Helen says she was pregnant at the time and suffering from high blood pressure, so Roberto decided to stay. ICE Public Affairs Officer Gail Montenegro says in a statement, when Roberto failed to depart the United States by that time as required, his voluntary order reverted to a final order of removal. That meant ICE could deport him, but Helen says he was allowed to stay as long as he kept working and didn't get into trouble. But the Trump administration is changing the way the government prioritizes people for deportation, expanding its efforts beyond just those who face criminal charges. Helen says she agrees with the president's stance on the issue.
We don't want to have cartels here. You don't want to have drugs in your high schools. You don't want to have killers next to you. You want to have, you know, you want to feel safe when you leave your house. I truly believe that. And this is why I voted for Mr. Trump, because of all his policies, of everything he said, I agree to that.
But Helen doesn't understand why her husband is among those being detained. She says he's an upstanding business owner who's in the process of applying for a green card, not a criminal. Now his stepson, Phil Koliopoulos, is trying to keep the family business running, not knowing what the future holds.
The worst would be deportation. And it's hard to think about that. And it's hard right now, too, because, you know, he has a grandson. And he can't see him grow up, you know.
Roberto's lawyer filed an application to keep him in the U.S. for at least the next 12 months. He's also trying to reopen his case for citizenship. But it's unclear when a decision will be made, and the process is often lengthy. For now, all Roberto's family can do is wait and hope immigration officials make a decision in his favor. Helen visits him once a week at a detention facility in Wisconsin and says Roberto wants nothing more than to come home to Indiana.
He's trying to hold up. He's trying to hold up. He said, I haven't done anything wrong. You know, I haven't committed a crime. Just the only crime I've done, he said, it's that I want to be here in the United States. This is my country. He said, I love this country.
If Roberto is deported, he could be barred from entering the United States for up to a decade. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
The 2017 Indiana Clean Marina Roundtable is coming up on Tuesday the 14th. It's going to be starting at 9:30 in the morning and will be held at the Portage Lakefront Park and Riverwalk. It's a very interesting event for people who are interested in certainly Lake Michigan waters. And if they like boating on Lake Michigan, they probably get the chance to use the marina there in Portage. And we have with us to talk about what this is all about. We have today to join us, we have Michelle Caldwell, who is with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. She is the Clean Marinas Program Coordinator here in Northwest Indiana. Michelle, thanks for joining us here and Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you, Chris, for having me.
For people who are not familiar with what the Clean Marina Program is, tell us about that and how IDEM fits into all of this, too. And if you will, tell us about the thoughts now behind the, what is going to be the third annual Indiana Clean Marina Roundtable.
Okay, thank you. Indiana's Clean Marina Program is a voluntary program. It's open to all marinas, boatyards, and yacht clubs throughout the state of Indiana, not just in Northwest Indiana. And it was developed in an effort to protect our state's inland and coastal waterways by reducing the potential environmental impacts associated with marinas and recreational boating. The Indiana Clean Marina Program provides information, technical assistance, and guidance to both marinas and recreational boaters. So by participating in this voluntary program, marinas, boatyards, yacht clubs can be recognized for their environmental stewardship. And recreational boaters can do their part in protecting Indiana's waterways by patronizing certified clean marinas. We have five in Northwest Indiana, and they can adopt clean boating habits. And we have a Indiana Clean Boaters Pledge that they can fill out.
Now, where are these clean marinas located, if people are not familiar with them?
Our very first designated Indiana Clean Marina is Hammond, the Hammond Port Authority. We have two in Michigan City. We have Washington Park Marina and Sprague Point Marina. We have Portage Public Marina. And then our latest one is Michiana Shores at Dune Harbor.
Wow. They're every place on Lake Michigan, it sounds like. I know that I'm sure your colleague statewide can have all the details, but the Clean Marina Program goes beyond just the big lakes like Lake Michigan. Probably covers a lot of rivers too that that might have opportunities for boating along there too, or other smaller lakes in Indiana, right?
Correct, and it's newer to the statewide expansion is newer to the program. My colleague Karen Taliha in our Indianapolis office is leading the the program down for the Ohio River mm-hmm. and lakes in central and other parts of Indiana.
That's great. Tell us, if you will, now a little bit more about what the roundtable is going to be on Tuesday. You mentioned some things I'm sure is going to be the same brought to the people attending the event in Portage. That's our part of the Clean Marina program, the importance of why marinas need to be clean. But tell us in a little bit more detail what you hope that will come about in the discussions there at the roundtable.
Well, the roundtable is an opportunity for marinas and boatyard operators as well as boaters to meet and discuss various issues that are affecting Indiana's marinas. It's also a chance to learn the benefits of Clean Marina program and mm-hmm. how to become an Indiana designated clean marina.
So, if there's a group that's out there that has a marina that isn't in the program right now, they can become a member if they follow the guidelines, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. If they come on out to the roundtable, and we have a guidebook that can be found online. And we have a checklist, and there's best management practices that marinas and boatyards and yacht clubs can do. And then we score them up, and if they get an 80% or better score, then they get to be a certified clean marina.
We're talking with Michelle Caldwell, who is with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management's Northwest Indiana Regional Office, which is based in Valparaiso, by the way, about the upcoming Clean Marina Roundtable on Tuesday in Portage.
For each year we do our roundtable, we ask one of Indiana's clean marinas to host the event. This year's agenda is really great. We have presentations on funding opportunities for marinas through grant programs that are handled in our Indianapolis office, such as the Clean Vessel Act Pump Out mm-hmm. program. There's a boating infrastructure grant program for marinas to install like transient docks and to help boaters that aren't there permanently through the season. We have a green infrastructure landscaping and stormwater mitigation measures presentation slated. Also, Indiana Department of Natural Resources, we have an aquatic invasive species specialist talking on how the marinas can manage aquatic invasive species. And a really great presentation from Vanessa Williams at Wild Goose Chase. They do bird management programs at not only marinas, but also beaches. And we have a pilot project that's going on in East Chicago, and she's giving an update on that, as well as other bird deterrent methods for marinas that they can implement. The second half of the roundtable meeting is a discussion that is led by our host, Clean Marina, and this year our roundtable is hosted by Barb Lesko, the harbor master of Portage Public Marina. Barb will facilitate a discussion with everybody on what issues they are facing. They can also help the new members in attendance if they have any questions that they're facing or any challenges they're facing, and also what successes they are having, and help. And it's a chance for everybody to help each other do the best they can with best management practices.
On a regular basis, you get to talk with organizations, with community groups and the like when these topics come up here about with some of the important things that people ought to know if they're boaters, if they happen to operate, say, marinas or other types of facilities. And we think, I guess, of the case of invasive species, mostly just strictly on Lake Michigan because of all the problems that we have had over the years with Asian carp and other types of things. But those things can invade and cause a lot of problems for people in marinas as well, too. It's just because you happen to be on the lake, right?
It can happen, yeah, on Lake Michigan and in our rivers, our tributaries, our inland lakes. The spread of aquatic invasives, you can talk about what boaters and fishermen can do to prevent the spread of the aquatic invasive species and best management practices on how to wash down their boats and their equipment. Aquatic invasive species can occur in all the water bodies in Indiana.
So they get a chance to find out more about that at the roundtable coming up if they're not familiar with that already, I suppose. So, now, if anybody's interested in attending the event, there's still plenty of time to get registered for this, is it not?
Yes, it's free. There's no RSVP or registration needed. So I hope people can stop by.
It's going to happen, by the way, on Tuesday, beginning at 9:30 in the morning, and it'll be at the Portage Lakefront Park and Walk, Riverwalk, which is at 1000 Riverwalk Drive in Portage. We've been talking with Michelle Caldwell, who is with the Northwest Regional Office of the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, and she is in charge as a coordinator of the Clean Marinas program, and will be one of those people who are helping put this big event on Tuesday. Michelle, thanks very much for talking with us about this. Hope you get a great crowd. A lot of people come in that are interested in marinas, in boating certainly, and helping do their part to help keep Lake Michigan and the waterways going into and coming out of Lake Michigan clean and free of problems. Thank you very much for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you, Chris.
An older audience of Indiana Farm Bureau members heard a younger perspective at their annual conference in Indianapolis this past weekend from the head of millennial engagement at the agribusiness giant Monsanto. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek tells us that he told farmers that they should rethink how they communicate about the food system.
Vance Crowe is one of many recent hires at Monsanto tasked with changing the public narrative about GMOs, industrial agriculture, and other controversial issues. He says his job involves talking to millennials and other innovators around the world about the questions, hopes, and fears they have for the food system. Crowe says farmers in conventional ag-heavy places like Indiana need to learn to have those conversations too, especially with young people and urban residents.
The best thing right now that I'm seeing farmers do is to show people why they do what they do.
Crowe says just explaining the science of something like GMOs isn't enough. He says farmers need a stronger story to sell than the one he says has sown fear among some consumers. Crafting that message, he says, will help farmers and farm bureaus cultivate another important group, the next generation of farmers themselves. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Hoosier lawmakers want to make it easier for domestic violence victims to keep their cell phones away from their abusers. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith at the State House reports that the bill that's being reviewed would provide this option after a victim gets a restraining order.
Under current law, only the owner of a cell phone account may see the full account and make changes. Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence's Laura Berry says that creates real problems for domestic violence victims.
Abusers have been able to use the apps within the family plans to be able to track them, unbeknownst to the victim.
Republican Senator Erin Houchin says her legislation would allow cell phone providers to give victims control of their own phone and number without permission of the primary account holder.
It will allow a victim to keep their vital contact information and stay connected to their network, their family and friends, and most importantly, have the ability to find shelter, support, and guidance.
Houchin says she expects easy passage in the House after the bill received unanimous support in the Senate. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
The Shirley Hines Land Trust here in Northwest Indiana is joining with the fellow conservators across the state of Indiana to celebrate tomorrow, I guess, 100,000 acres of land that has been saved here in the Hoosier State. And with us to talk more about this special ceremony at the State House is Chris Krause, who is the executive director of the Shirley Hines Land Trust. Chris, thanks for joining us here and Ridgely Speaking.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit here about this very important get-together that's going to happen at the State House tomorrow and how the Shirley Hines Land Trust fits into all this.
Yeah, so the Nature Conservancy is celebrating 100,000 acres being permanently protected at the Indiana State House tomorrow from 4 to 6. And it's really a monumental achievement for all of us and as residents and in the state of Indiana, and that we have collectively protected a substantial amount of land. It is something that really took off several years ago when the state established the Indiana Heritage Trust Fund. Mm-hmm. So anyone that has an environmental license plate is contributing to a land acquisition fund that makes it possible for organizations like Shirley Hines to go out and protect property. And then a few years ago, in celebration of the bicentennial, the Nature Conservancy worked with the governor's office, and Governor Daniels set aside $20 million for land protection in the state of Indiana. That was leveraged for another $10 million from the Lilly Foundation, making $30 million available for land protection in our state. And those funds really spurred a lot of the acres that have recently been protected. And locally speaking, it has made it possible for organizations like Shirley Hines to protect places like Meadowbrook Nature Preserve in Porter County, many parcels along the east branch of the Little Calumet River Conservation Corridor in Porter and LaPorte County, and Lake County Parks, Porter County Parks, and other conservation groups in the region have been able to tap into that funding source to protect the land. So the celebration tomorrow is really focused on groups throughout the state of Indiana that have been able to protect land for people within the state of Indiana. And it is a real credit to the Nature Conservancy and land trusts throughout the state and the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Nature Preserves, and other DNR departments for, you know, working diligently to protect our natural areas in this in our state.
Chris, would you say how many acres are within the Shirley Hines Land Trust here in our counties, Lake Porter and LaPorte counties, that have been able to be part of the 100,000 acres now across the state?
We have permanently protected 2,262 acres in our organization's history. As it relates to the recent Bicentennial Nature Trust program that is now going to be referred to going forward as the President Benjamin Harrison Conservation Trust, that program specifically has made it possible for us to protect right about 600 acres. So probably between 500 and 600 acres. So
this is all land that probably people don't even recognize as being protected or are in need of being protected. You mentioned about the along the east bank of the Little Calumet River, to be particular, but you know, there probably is places that people don't even recognize that are either in need of being protected, and luckily they are because they're part of the land trust, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah, there is. And I think as our organization and other organizations have developed their capacity and done things like conservation planning, where we prioritize the natural assets of our region, there's things like the Greenways and Blueways Plan that NRPC has developed. And those planning efforts and initiatives make it possible for us to really zero in and prioritize the resources that we have available for land protection and even restoration. So, but we do have a lot of spectacular natural areas in Northwest Indiana. So,
I would imagine that probably most people wouldn't even think of it from even certainly maybe by just visiting a lot of these places, beautiful scenery, but for even just a recreational standpoint. You mentioned the NRPC program that is underway that luckily takes advantage of a lot of this Shirley Hines Land Trust property, isn't it?
I think the one thing we sometimes forget about when property is protected is the not just the public benefit of protecting these natural areas for plants and animals and wildlife, but also the opportunity it creates for us to be able to go out and recreate, access, and enjoy nature. And so Meadowbrook's a great example where we have 5 miles of trails, and it's open to the public and from dusk to dawn, and we're able to you know, people can come out and enjoy the resource at no charge. So it's a great public amenity that we're able to provide with a lot of these places that have been protected.
Now, Chris, how difficult would it be for a landowner or family members of a landowner, maybe that had that land bequeathed to them through a will or whatever? How difficult is it for them to be able to put this land into the land trust to help keep it preserved like this in its best condition?
So for us and a lot of other organizations, we have acquisition criteria and priorities, and so we go through the process of assessing, and we do get approached with such opportunities, and we look at how it fits into our goals and what the ecological and natural value of the property is, and whether or not we're best suited to manage that property in perpetuity, or if there might be a more appropriate entity. So it's each acquisition opportunity, you know, it can go a couple different ways, and we go through a rigorous process to make sure that it's something that we can maintain into the future, and you know, that it has the right natural attributes we're looking for in a property.
If anybody's interested in getting some property involved in the land trust, how can they find out more?
They should do one of two things. They can either call us at our office. The number is 219-242-8558, or they can visit Shirley Hines Land Trust website at www.heinze-trust.org and get more details on how to contact the office.
Chris Krause is the executive director of the Shirley Hines Land Trust here in Northwest Indiana, and its acreage going along with many other acres in land trust across the Hoosier State. Part of the presentation coming up tomorrow at the State House, talking about all this about 100,000 acres of land that has been put into land trusts across Indiana. And Chris, thanks for the update. And the best of luck to you, and hope that we find more acreage in the Shirley Hines Land Trust coming in here. Certainly as a result of the bicentennial that we've just finished with, and in the years ahead too. Thanks for talking with us today about it.
Thank you, Chris.
There are jobs to be found here in Northwest Indiana.
About 1,000 prospective employees attended a job fair on Thursday at the Hammond Civic Center. Africa Tarver, Director of Economic Development with the City of Hammond, says 84 companies were at the job fair ready to talk to candidates.
So this is basically a service that we offer to not only our residents, but residents in neighboring communities, where we compare job seekers with employment opportunities.
She says the event has experienced huge growth since Hammond's first job fair 14 years ago.
What kind of outcome are you looking for? Do you have any idea of how many people actually attain jobs as a result of this event today?
Well, I spoke to an employer earlier today, and he said from last year's job fair, he had quite a few people that he hired. The challenge with tracking numbers is that a lot of times when companies come, they accept a lot of applications or resumes, they put them in a database, and then they continuously pull from that database for their hiring needs.
Tarver says she thinks the event is an important vehicle that addresses the hiring needs of Hammond and the surrounding communities. She says it's valuable in the way that it gives job seekers an opportunity to go to one place and speak face-to-face with potential employers. Dan Capora, Director of Roofing Operations for Corellis Roofing, one of the organizations that took part in the job fair, says typically the company hires through its union hall, but Corellis is now taking its own initiative to find candidates.
We just started doing job fairs last year, trying to get some millennials in. We figured we're from Hammond, we'd start off with the Hammond job fair. Hire local.
The Hammond Job Fair was a partnership between the City of Hammond, Work One, the North Township Trustee's Office, and ResCare. Work One manager Rich Sapper says his company's role is focused on helping to make those important connections.
You pretty much get your objective carried out by connecting people, applicants, with employers?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what it's all about. You know, it starts with employers. It always starts with employers. Because, let's be honest, if we don't have employers that have jobs, we can't find people jobs. So what we look for is we look for what employers are looking for, and our business service team is out here connecting with some of them to try to find out what their needs are, so that the people that we're working with, we can fit in the best way possible to the employer needs.
For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
On this Monday, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Kirk Muspratt, music director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. Welcome back, Kirk.
Hi, John.
So we're going to talk about the last classical concert of our 75th season.
Yes.
So what is Bernstein?
Mm-hmm. Next year, John, as you know, is Leonard Bernstein's 100th birthday.
Thank you for reminding me. I might have forgotten to buy him a gift.
Yeah, in 1918 he's born. So everybody's going to be doing Bernstein next year. So I thought, let's get a jump early on it before everybody's doing it.
Yeah.
And his Symphony of Psalms, he was commissioned to do this in 1965, and it is for full chorus, which will be beautiful, full orchestra. Actually, there's six percussionists in it. Because one of the psalms is about make a joyful noise.
Oh, good.
And it's all in Hebrew, which is very challenging for the chorus. And I'm hoping a lot of our Jewish friends, just because we don't get to do things in Hebrew so often, will come and join us for this, because we do things in French and Italian and German all the time.
No, it sounds exotic.
Yeah, it is. And there's all kinds of psalms, because there's everything from why do we war with each other to the Lord is my shepherd, the Psalm 23, but all in Hebrew. So.
Well, this is a good time of year to be doing this, too, because while Easter is quite late this year, and I assume Passover is, too, it's that time of year when people, you know, spring and resurrection and
absolutely
all that good stuff. So.
Yeah, lilies. And John, also, just if you don't mind, I wanted to tell you that we have, for the first time in my life, I'm working with a countertenor.
Yeah, tell us about it. What is a countertenor?
It's a person who has, you might have a speaking voice like mine. I have a sort of baritone. But he has the ability in his vocal technical range to sing up here.
Falsetto.
Yeah, but it actually, what's interesting is it isn't actually a falsetto.
It isn't?
It actually is a register in his voice, so he doesn't have to sing like you and I would in a falsetto. And he came and worked with me yesterday. His name is Thomas Allan, and he's a young conductor and composer and singer, and he's got just a beautiful voice. So either a boy sings the part or a countertenor.
Is he exclusively a countertenor?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's just a beautiful, pure voice for expressing that the Lord is my shepherd, you know, psalm. And it's a beautiful voice. I heard him 2 years ago audition, and so now we got a countertenor.
And what makes these? All right, we have to give it up and talk about something else.
Okay,
quickly. What makes them the Chichester Psalm?
Oh, because of the cathedral in southern England, the Chichester Cathedral, where they commissioned him to do this piece.
I'm good with that. Okay.
Okay. Great.
And Mozart and Beethoven are also on this.
Yes. So we have our wonderful Janet Engel, who's our principal oboist, playing the Mozart Oboe Concerto, which will put us all in heaven. And then my favorite, actually, believe it or not, Beethoven Symphony No. 4.
I understand. So not the ninth.
Not the ninth, not the fifth, not the seventh, not the third. All fantastic, all genius. But I love this fourth. It's like the little, I don't know, it's the little sister of some of them. And it's so funny and so full of zip and flirtation and fun and not the serious Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Speaking of oboists, I finally broke down. I thought it would be too close to what we do for a living, and I couldn't bear the thought of watching Mozart in the Jungle.
Oh.
But I, of course, consumed all three seasons of it in 1 week.
Oh.
And have you seen it?
No, not at all. I just know about
you're
the
original. You're like me.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear about it.
Yeah, yeah. But, and?
I don't want to hear about their struggles. Well, because I'm Bernadette Peters.
Oh, you are?
And you're Gael Garcia Bernal.
Oh, is he bad?
Oh, he's fabulous.
Oh, okay, good. Okay.
No. He's,
oh, okay.
They're both incredible. And actually, the worst among them is the retired conductor, who is played by Malcolm McDowell. It's a riot.
And does it tell the truth about what goes on in our business?
Yeah, and it's a lot about the union musicians. That's a lot about their lives. It's a big soap opera.
Yeah, yeah.
But the oboist, a girl who would like to be a full-time oboist in the orchestra that he conducts, is because he's like a Dudamel type.
Yes.
Gael Garcia Bernal. And she would like to be in the orchestra, and she becomes his assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And her name is Haley. He calls her Hailai.
Oh.
That's his
very
little
exotic
nickname. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's great. And I recommend it to anybody, but I don't recommend that they watch that and not come to our concert.
No. But as with Amadeus, if not everything in the movie about, you know, Mozart is true, but it raises everyone's consciousness about the genius of Mozart. And if this raises everybody's consciousness about symphony, totally cool.
Yeah. And Mozart talks to him, appears to him and talks to
him.
Other conductors do as well, but primarily primarily Mozart does.
Oh, very lucky. I don't get this.
Yeah. So, no, you don't get this. No, I'm sorry, Kirk. All right. Well, thanks for being here to tell us about our final classical concert of the season. And we'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
As John Kane talking today with Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra conductor and musical director Kirk Muspratt as they come into the 75th anniversary of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. Eye on the Arts conversations are here on Mondays on Regionally Speaking. You can also find them as well on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.